Welcome to A Hard Look, the Administrative Law Review podcast from the Washington College of Law. We'll discuss how administrative law impacts your daily life, from regulatory actions by agencies and the litigation over them to the balance of power among branches of the government. This is A Hard Look.
Welcome to Administrative Law Review's A Hard Look. Stephen and I are switching seats, so I will be your host for this episode. Today, I am joined by Eric Dunn, who is a national expert on tenants' rights and consumer law issues, known for high-impact advocacy on matters affecting subsidized housing tenants and families struggling to access housing because of criminal and eviction records. Prior to joining the National Housing Law Project, Eric was an attorney with the Virginia Poverty Law Center, the Northwest Justice Project in Seattle, and the Legal Aid and Defender Association of Detroit. As a disclaimer, the views of our guest are his own and are not a reflection of that of his firm, organization's clients, or other parties in which his opinions could be imputed. On this episode of A Hard Look, we will be discussing the eviction moratorium and housing crisis at large within the context of administrative law. All right, Mr. Dunn, welcome to A Hard Look.
Thanks for having me.
So I chiefly wanted to discuss the recent eviction moratorium case from the SCOTUS shadow docket, which was Alabama Association of Realtors versus Department of Health and Human Services. Just to get us started, what are some Article II powers that you see were raised in this case?
Article II powers, the basis for the CDC's imposition of the eviction halt was under the Public Health Services Act, which was enacted pursuant to Commerce Clause authority. And then what the case dealt with was whether, really two things. One, whether the original Public Health Services Act, which was passed in 1944, carried sufficient authority for the agencies created under that act, one of them being the CDC, to restrict residential evictions when necessary to curtail the spread of a communicable disease. And then the second question would be, even if the 1944 Act didn't carry that authority, did Congress ratify the CDC's exercise of that power when they extended the CDC order in the Consolidated Appropriations Act in December of 2020?
And how do you think that kind of plays into how we view different agencies? For example, we see the Department of Defense, we haven't officially declared war in decades, but there really isn't a complaint about DOD kind of overreaching its scope. But when we see other executive agencies such as HUD and CDC, we kind of see this complaint a bit more. How do you think that kind of factors into how we view these cases?
Well, I mean, it seems to be, the people on sort of the right side of the political spectrum that have a complaint with the federal government having certain powers, and people on the right tend to complain less about the federal government using its powers to declare war and bomb people and things like that, than when they're using their authority to protect everyday people and address things like, public health threats and environmental problems and poverty and things of that nature. So I think that's probably why you see fewer people arguing that the federal government doesn't have the authority to launch wars without congressional authorization, then you would see complaining about the federal government having authority to step in and prevent evictions in the middle of a public health crisis.
Right. And speaking of different agencies, this case was centered on housing, but it involved the Department of Health and Human Services and not the Department of Housing and Urban Development. I don't know if you've had any personal or professional experience about how those two agencies work. Do you think it would have been better to pursue this under HUD? Or how do you think HUD's impact has been during the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, I think one of the really problematic dynamics of the whole, eviction hall being from CDC was that you're talking about an agency that doesn't really have any history or expertise around housing. There was some lip service, I think, given to collaboration with HUD in one of the FAQ documents that they put out, but that really appeared to have been the product of negotiations in litigation between the DOJ lawyers representing CDC and some of the law firms representing the landlord challengers. And HUD's involvement in that was quite superficial. some of the, even when the CDC eviction halt was in effect, I mean, there were some real problems with it. A lot of people didn't benefit from it. It really didn't stop evictions and stop the spread of COVID-19 as well as it could have. CDC was really kind of a black box as far as housing advocates were concerned. Efforts that housing advocates made to communicate with CDC and bring these issues to its attention, really went unanswered, especially, during the fall of 2020, before the new administration came in. And I think, HUD is an organization that does have, expertise and at least some level of knowledge around, housing issues and rental housing issues. But they weren't the ones that were responsible for it. At the same time, HUD doesn't have CDC's expertise with dealing with infectious disease, which, of course, HUD, HUD's performance in the pandemic has really been quite dismal. I mean, HUD hasn't even stopped evictions in the properties that HUD itself funds and regulates, which, really there's no excuse for that as far as housing advocates are concerned. I mean, they have full authority to do that and just chose not to. I think what really gave rise to the CDC eviction halt was the failure of Congress in the summer of 2020 to pass first the HEROES Act, which was a bill that had been passed by the House of Representatives, and then basically the Senate never took it up and passed it, and then McConnell dismissed the Republican-controlled Senate right before Labor Day, which was right around the time that the previous federal protection on some evictions was we're talking about the CARES Act eviction moratorium, which was passed in March of 2020. That only covered about a third or so of, nobody knows exactly how many people were covered due to the way the coverage worked. For example, you could be covered if you lived in a property that had other Section 8 voucher tenants, but you wouldn't necessarily know how many units were in that building. So it's estimated that about a third of the rental market was covered with that bill, or that law, I should say. But it only lasted through July 24th. And then there was a 30-day notice period, which was going to expire at the end of August. And so we were heading into September with no federal protection at all for anybody. And we would have had experts, estimates were between 19 and 23 million evictions, in a country with about 43 million renter households. We're talking about potentially more than half of renters could have been evicted within a matter of about 10 weeks. So the federal government really had to do something. And, even though the formal rationale for, the CDC to act was purely, protect the public health. I mean, that was certainly a big part of it. But we would have seen, favelas in the United States. It would have been just a complete bloodbath if the government hadn't done something. But having the CDC step in with no expertise, no knowledge of housing, and just drop something up is not what anybody, I think, really wanted to see.
Yeah, so on that note, do you think that could have been a better legal mechanism that the federal government could have used to kind of have more teeth to an eviction moratorium?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think, certainly Congress could have just passed another statute like they did in the CARES Act. And you know, the HEROES Act would have contained a complete moratorium on substantially all evictions, you know, for the rest of the pandemic, which is what we really needed the whole time. But even, you know, if we're talking about something coming from the CDC could have done a better job. You know, first of all, they required tenants to sign this declaration form. So if you don't know about the moratorium, you know, if you have some kind of impediment to signing that form and so forth, you're not going to be covered. Again, if our goal is to prevent evictions because evictions spread COVID-19, we want everybody covered. We don't want people just missing out because they didn't do something. Right. So that was really at odds with the whole, you know, public health purpose. Then it was limited only to non-payment of rent evictions, which again, it shouldn't matter why somebody's being evicted. If an eviction spreads COVID-19, then it should also cover somebody who's being evicted because their pet weighs too much or because their sister's living there and isn't on the lease. It doesn't make any sense, but you know, it was limited to non-payment evictions. And then there was the requirement that somebody have made all efforts to obtain government rental assistance. You know, well, again, why not let somebody go and seek rental assistance later, prevent the eviction if we're trying to stop evictions to spread COVID-19. But it seemed like what the CDC was really doing was just trying to prevent like the neediest people who had nowhere else to go, who had done everything they possibly could to avoid being evicted, and basically reduce the numbers. But they weren't really interested in stopping all evictions, which is what you would do if you were genuinely interested in protecting the public health. So I think there was, you know, there was a lot of problems just in terms of the CDC's real commitment to actually doing what they set out to do, which was, I think, a lot, you know, was really happening, I think, with a lot of this. And then once the CDC order had been in effect for a while, we started seeing workarounds that never should have been allowed, or the CDC, you know, could have issued guidance documents or interpretations to stop them. A good example was the original text of the CDC halt order said that it defined eviction as being taking any action to remove or cause the removal of a covered tenant from a rental property. Well, when we first read that, we thought, well, that's great. Taking any action, that means you can't file an eviction lawsuit. You can't physically remove somebody from a property. You can't go give somebody an eviction notice. You can't take any action. And that's the plain meaning of any action. But then the city says, well, we just mean any action like at the end, like to actually physically put the person out. So you can still file cases in court and you can still serve eviction notices. Well, guess what? I mean, if you serve eviction notices, people get an eviction notice and it says you got to move out at the end of the month, people move out.
Right.
If you let landlords file eviction lawsuits in court, well, if you get a case filed against you, now you've got an eviction record. Good luck renting somebody out somewhere else because another landlord will turn you down. So people will move out because they don't want to get an eviction record. If your goal is to stop evictions because evictions spread COVID-19, then you should stick to your guns and say you can't take any action to remove somebody. If you just say, well, you can only do these final things at the end, guess what? You're going to lose a lot of people. You're going to have a lot of evictions before they ever get to that point. Another workaround that we saw is the CDC order says it stops evictions for non-payment of rent, but there's different rules in different states that you can use to evict somebody for non-payment of rent. So if you have a 12-month lease and you're only in your third month and you don't pay the rent, usually the landlord has to give you a specific kind of notice saying, I am evicting you for non-payment of rent because you have an unexpired lease. The landlord has to have some kind of cause. They can't just go and tell you to move out. You've got 9 months left on your lease. But if you've got a month-to-month tenancy or you've got a lease that's coming up for expiration, the landlord can say, oh, well, I'm not going to renew your lease, or I'm just terminating your month-to-month tenancy. I'm not giving you a reason. Now, the actual reason might be because you're behind in rent, but they don't have to actually prove that. They don't have to tell you how much you owe, give you a chance to pay it, anything like that. They just give you this notice. So we started to see landlords that would want to evict people for non-payment of rent, but they couldn't because of the CDC halt order. So they would just give somebody a non, you know, no cause lease termination notice, mm-hmm. or just say, well, I'm not renewing your lease then. And not, it's not for non-payment of rent. I just want the property back. I don't have a reason. Of course you have a reason. It doesn't make any sense. And the CDC, you know, we asked them repeatedly to fix this and they didn't do it. And, you know, is it because they don't understand housing? They don't understand landlord-tenant law? They don't have any expertise in it? Or is it because they really didn't want to? And their real goal was just to try to mitigate the effects, but they weren't really concerned about stopping, you know, anything close to all evictions. You know, probably a little of both. I don't know. As I said, it's a black box. We didn't really get any kind of, you know, real insight into what they were thinking at the CDC.
Right. The court had mentioned in their opinion that landlords had faced irreparable harm. But a common issue that kind of arose across the board is that despite covering missed and even future rent, landlords were rejecting rental assistance. So how could we legally address that issue if we have landlords who are claiming that they're facing irreparable damage from non-payment of rent, for example, but they're refusing to even engage with the process of filing for emergency rental assistance and then refusing those funds?
Well, in the fall of 2020, when the CDC eviction halt first took effect, and landlord groups started filing lawsuits challenging it, you know, the first thing they asked for were preliminary injunctions. They wanted the courts to step in and stop this thing right away. Well, you can't get a preliminary injunction unless you can show that you're going to be irreparably harmed. And the classic way that courts look at irreparable harm is there going to be something that happens to you that can't be compensated for with money? Well, what's the harm that landlords were facing? They're not getting the rent money and they might not be able to collect it later from people because these aren't rich people. Well, that's not an irreparable harm, right? I mean, if your injury is you didn't get your rent money, then you can get a judgment for that money in the future and, you know, you're made whole. Now, you may or may not collect it, but that's historically how courts have looked at irreparable harm. And so all of those motions for preliminary injunction failed. Now, in some courts, you know, there were additional reasons those motions failed because the courts looked at the merits and said, no, the CDC has authority to do this. This is legit. You know, we need to have a moratorium to stop the spread of COVID-19. The CDC is the experts on this. But every court that looked at a preliminary injunction came to the conclusion that, well, this is not irreparable harm. You're complaining about money and denied that. And even when landlords said, well, what if we don't collect it? You know, this isn't just that we're not getting the money, we'll never get the money. The courts noted that, well, look, Congress might appropriate money to pay these rents. I mean, it already did in the CARES Act at that point. And then sure enough, in the Appropriations Act in December, Congress appropriated $25 billion to pay delinquent rents. And then it added another $20 billion and change in the American Rescue Plan. You know, over $46 billion has been appropriated to pay these rents. And we start seeing landlords be like, I don't want the money. I don't want it. You know, and yeah, it's completely, you know, I think disingenuous to say that, oh, irreparable harm because we can't get this rent money. And then when the government says, well, here, you know, here's money to pay that rent that you're owed. And then the landlords say, well, it's not about money, you know. And, you know, for a lot of landlords, it's really not about the money. They just want to have total control over who lives in their properties and under what conditions. And, you know, a lot of these landlords just sort of view themselves as like feudal, you know, feudal lords of, you know, their tenants are like serfs and they're just going to dominate people's lives. I mean, that's their approach. And it really isn't about the money. You know, the other side of it is that Congress right away during the pandemic passed strong protections against foreclosure. So, you know, landlords haven't really had to worry about getting their properties foreclosed. If they're not collecting rent money, you know, they can give forbearances. You know, there's other options available even for people who've had tenants that haven't been able to pay. And the industry research has shown that landlords have made higher profits during the pandemic than even before. So it really has not been, you know, financial hardship on landlords as a group. Now, maybe there may be some individuals who've had different experiences depending on sort of the unique factors relevant to them, but by and large, landlords have not suffered at all. you know, from the effects of the pandemic, which is, you know, saying something because most people have had had some issues to deal with.
Right. And so after this decision came out and the federal eviction moratorium was canceled, a lot of like jurisdictions started doing their own version. So there was a really local movement and local action. How do you think those have been panning out for, you know, individual cities who passed their own versions of eviction bans?
Well, I mean, the way this really worked was that you saw a lot of states and cities acting first before there was anything at the federal level. And it wasn't, you know, until end of March, you know, which, you know, at the outset of the pandemic, I mean, it seemed like an eternity between, you know, the early part of March when people are still kind of first dawning on people that there's a pandemic, this is serious, we need to do something, and March 27th when the CARES Act was finally passed. You know, during that, you know, almost 4 week period there, you know, we saw states and cities all around the country enacting various types of eviction moratoria to protect, you know, to protect tenants against evictions, to protect the public health, you know, to make sure that people weren't being thrown on the street and then having, you know, excessive interpersonal contacts and, you know, not able to maintain hygiene and things like that. And then, you know, the hope at the outset was that, well, this is just, we just need these state and local measures for a short period of time. And then the federal government, of course, will come in with this big comprehensive moratorium. It never happened. You know, the best we got was the CARES Act for 120 days. And then the CDC order that one of lasting close to a year after that. And as I mentioned before, both of those protections had a lot of people left behind, had a lot of loopholes, had a lot of workarounds. You know, we even saw courts that just simply refused to enforce these things. And, you know, our organization just did a survey of our membership. We have an organization of over 1,600 housing advocates around the country that we coordinate. And our membership reported about 20% of the courts that they are active in have never honored the Federal CARES Act notice requirement. But that's still a federal law. It's on the books. It's 15 U.S. Code Section 9058. It's still there. And courts just say, well, we don't do that here. You know, 20%. And more than three quarters of courts, 78%, said that advocates reported that the courts don't consistently apply that. So sometimes they will, other times they won't. So, and we've seen that with other rules. And one of the real important provisions under landlord-tenant law for time immemorial, and this has always been a requirement. You know, eviction cases are summary proceedings. You know, you don't get months to do discovery and negotiate and file motions in an eviction case. You usually get a couple of weeks or maybe even a few days between when the case is served on you and when you've got to be in court for your dispositive hearing. And, you know, it means you don't have time to find a lawyer. You don't have time to investigate the case. You don't have time to do formal discovery, even if the rules allow for it. You're not going to have much of a chance to prepare. And so the courts have always said, okay, well, then we're going to really limit the circumstances where you can use this type of case. And one of the basic requirements is you can't file it just to collect a debt. You can't file it unless the tenant is holding over on the property illegally. And that means you can't file it in anticipation of somebody doing it. You got to wait till they're actually there beyond the deadline to move out. And then we're going to decide, okay, on this day, who's entitled to possession of this property? That's all we're going to decide. Well, when the CDC started saying, okay, look, you know what? Our order doesn't actually prevent you from filing the case. It only prevents you from putting somebody out. We thought, okay, well, you know what? That's actually not that big of a deal because the landlords still can't file cases against people until they're actually illegally there. And when they're lawfully occupying under the CDC order, they're not illegally there. So the landlord shouldn't be able to file a case then. And courts start saying, well, we're not going to file that. What do you mean we're not going to file that? That's the law. That's always been the law. That's the law everywhere. No, you can still file the case. And you know, and it's created this screwy situation where landlords would get these judgments that would say, the landlord is entitled to judgment for possession of the premises, but the judgment is stayed because the tenant is entitled to possession of the premises. Huh? and this was happening in a lot of jurisdictions. And so, I'm sorry, I feel like I kind of lost the the initial question that you asked me and kind of went off on a tangent here. But that's the, yeah, we saw a lot of problems. We still see a lot of problems with local courts just sort of not accepting any of these, you know, federal or sometimes even the state protections. And of course, now that the federal protections are gone, all we have in some local areas are you know, lingering state restrictions on evictions. You know, some communities never even really had a formal eviction moratorium. They would have a judicial order saying, you know, court saying, okay, it's not safe to have court practice. We can't have hearings right now because, you know, there's a pandemic and people are going to come into a court building and then they're, you know, it's going to be a confined area. People are going to be close quarters and everybody's going to get sick. So we're just going to shut down the court. And that means that no eviction cases are going to get heard. And then a little while later, they would figure out, okay, we're going to hear some cases remotely. And we're going to let some people into the courtroom under these conditions with masks and space people out and stuff. And at some point they started being able to hold eviction cases again. And so that's kind of how the moratorium would be lifted. But you look and see, did their governor ever do anything? Did their legislature ever do anything? Did mayors and city councils ever do anything? And the answer would be no, that in a lot of places, you know, evictions, you know, if they were stopped at all, it was only because of the sort of judicial emergency considerations around social distancing.
Right. There was also a lot of kind of discommunication between the agencies that were administrating the emergency rental assistance and like courts. So for example, a lot of evictions had to be stayed as long as there was an like emergency assistance application pending, but there were lots of stories of like people missing it by like 10 minutes or so, and then the court still carrying out the eviction, and that just became kind of very disharmonious. So trying to like wrap things up a bit, because this topic could honestly go on forever. So basically, we're all too familiar with the rising cost of living and how volatile the housing market was even before the pandemic. And how do you think that COVID-19 shows us a glimpse into the housing crisis at large?
Well, I mean, you know, the National Low Income Housing Coalition prepares a couple of reports every year. You know, they update every year. One is called The Gap, and it basically shows sort of the difference between how many affordable housing units we actually have and how many we actually need, you know, given, you know, how many people we have at different income levels. And, you know, the big number, I think, from that report is that for years we've had about a 7 million unit shortage of affordable housing for people who are in the extremely low income categories. These are the people that are most at risk of becoming homeless, and really have truly dire consequences, you know, if they're paying too much for their housing and something happens. With a 7 million unit shortage, I mean, you know, that calls for drastic measures. I mean, as I mentioned before, we have about 43 million rental households in the country. So 7 million, you know, compared to 43 million, that's, you know, that's a lot. And, you know, we need to keep the affordable housing units we have. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of the affordable housing we have is old and in various states of disrepair, and we haven't made the kinds of investments we need to fix it up and maintain it. You know, that there's money in the Build Back Better Act to do a lot of that maintenance and repair. And now it looks like that act is really on life support, may not pass. But we need to preserve as many of the units as we can. We also have about 400,000 units of rural affordable housing, which, you know, right now there's a problem with a lot of those units being prepaid. So the owners can prepay their loans, and then the residents in those units don't get the subsidy anymore. The price goes up. But toward the end of this decade, we're going to see a lot of those loans maturing. So owners just paying them off, and then they just exit the program. So we need to make arrangements to try to keep those properties in the program. We need to expand the Section 8 voucher program. We have only about enough vouchers for 1 in 5 households that qualify for them. And you know, the waiting lists can be years. And that's even if you get on a waiting list. You only have to enter a lottery just to get your name on the waiting list, and then you got to wait years you know, for it to come up. And then once you get a voucher, it can be difficult to actually find a place to rent with a voucher. And so, you know, we don't have enough affordable housing. You know, we don't have enough housing supports for people to rent in the private market. And then we're seeing, you know, the other report the Low-Income Housing Coalition produces every year is called Out of Reach. And it basically compares how much housing costs with how much people actually make. And, you know, this has been the case for a while now, that there's not a single county in the country where somebody making minimum wage can even come close to affording a modest apartment. And in a lot of places, you would need to work two or three minimum wage jobs to afford just a basic place to live. And so what that means is that we have lots of people all around the country, pretty much everywhere, large numbers of people that are paying well over 30% of their income just toward rent and utilities. In a lot of cases, paying well over 50% of their income toward rent and utilities. And when you're paying that much just to keep a roof over your head, you know, first of all, you've already got to make some sacrifices, often in terms of, you know, basic necessities. You know, you're deciding between food and medicine and car repairs and things like that already. But then if some, you know, if you have any kind of disruption, if you have, you know, your hours get slashed at work, you get laid off, you know, you have some really unexpected expense that you just can't avoid, then the whole house of cards just comes tumbling down because you had no ability to save. You couldn't afford things that you needed as it was. And now, you know, you're just done. And so I think with the pandemic, having, you know, tens of millions of people have a disruption like that, you know, simultaneously, you know, that's what led to this threat of, you know, just a tsunami of evictions, you know, 19 to 23 million evictions. And, you know, we could face something like that again, you know, not necessarily the pandemic, but, you know, there could be some other kind of national emergency like that. And if it means people aren't going into work, you know, people aren't making the income that they expect, or they have unexpected bills that they need to pay, you know, they're not going to have savings. They're not going to have reserves that they can turn to. And we could face another crisis of that same nature.
Well, kind of sobering news, but thank you so much, Mr. Dunn, for joining me on this episode of season 3 of A Hard Look and sharing your expertise and your insight into this housing crisis issue. Do you have any final comments for our listeners?
Well, I mean, there are some things that I think we could do to really put the COVID-19 housing crisis, you know, sort of in the rearview mirror. One is, you know, the people that lost their jobs or had their incomes disrupted kind of early on in the pandemic, they got behind in rent. They eventually got new jobs or got back to work, and they've been able to pay their rent sort of on an ongoing basis, but they still have that arrearage hanging over their head. You know, there's been some states already that have passed, you know, we've been calling it non-evictable debt, but different states have different terms for it. But basically it's the idea that, look, let's just carve off this arrearage and deal with it separately. People can apply for rental assistance. People can do payment plans, you know, whatever. But you shouldn't evict somebody who's paying the current rent just because they owe an arrearage from before, you know, during the pandemic. That doesn't do the landlord any good, because if you bring in, you evict that tenant and bring in a new tenant, that new tenant's not paying the old tenant's arrearage either. So it doesn't really accomplish right. anything for the landlord, and it just disrupts communities and you know, poses hardships on individuals. So, you know, New Jersey has a really good version of this. You know, California has kind of a version of this. You have to have paid a percentage of your arrearage, but, you know, nowhere near the whole thing. New York, you know, allows for what they call non-possessory judgments. So landlord can get a judgment for the money, but they can't evict you. We need to see more states adopting common sense measures like that. Secondly, there have been a lot of people who, even if they didn't get evicted, they still got sued for eviction, or they may still have this rental arrearage, and maybe they're, you know, maybe their housing no longer works for them, but they're just living there because now they can't get in somewhere else because they have this eviction record, or they have landlord tenant debt that they haven't been able to pay. We need to have protections for these kinds of people so that people with eviction records and other adverse rental history from the pandemic, you know, aren't sort of left long-term in kind of a second-class housing market where they can't get into quality, you know, safe homes that, that work for them. We need to have more tenant screening protections. And I think, you know, another really important aspect of this we haven't really had a chance to talk about is that, you know, this has been a problem that's been most heavily felt among people of color. I mean, even before the pandemic, evictions were something that happened most frequently to Black women, especially with children. So we're talking about Black mothers. And of course, we've seen, you know, all of the indicators of the pandemic. You know, it was African-Americans who were hit the hardest with job losses, African-Americans who were hit the hardest with the actual health effects, the hospitalizations and fatalities and so forth with the pandemic. And of course, with pandemic evictions. And so if we don't enact these kinds of protections, if we don't enable people who've been through an eviction or even, you know, maintain their housing despite an eviction filing, if we don't enable them to be able to qualify for housing somewhere else, you know, that over time we're going to see COVID-19 turn into just a mass residential segregation effect, because the people that acquired these records and you know, who can't get access to the quality housing now are disproportionately, you know, Black women especially. So, you know, we really need to take a number of measures to protect tenants and protect through the integrity of you know, the society, you know, from massive segregation.
So you mentioned common sense things that states can do, but I know that New York recently passed a right to counsel for housing cases. And I was wondering what you thought of that, if you see a trend amongst other states, maybe adopting that, like they're adopting, you know, eviction sealing laws.
Yeah, well, New York was one of the first, it may have been the first in the country to adopt right to counsel, but now we're up to, I think, three states and about 12 or 13 other cities that have it, including some places you may not expect. I mean, there's right to counsel in Toledo, Ohio now, for example, as well as, you know, of course, New York and San Francisco and you know, the state of Washington has it. I mean, I think, you know, it's important. I mean, not only do tenants need to have lawyers to represent them, they need to have substantive rights and protections that they can actually enforce, and they need to have a meaningful hearing at which to present those things. So I think, you know, it doesn't matter which leg of the stool you start with. I mean, you need all three of those legs for it to stand. Right. And, you know, right to counsel is really important because a lot of times, you know, tenants may have defenses that they can assert. They have rights and protections that they can rely on to save their housing, or at least to get a soft landing in the, you know, where they can, maybe they can't keep this property, but they can move in somewhere else and avoid becoming homeless. But if they don't have legal counsel to identify what those protections are, to understand how to negotiate with the landlord, they're not going to be successful. So it's great to see that there's momentum behind right to counsel. And yeah, absolutely. That would be something that's important to see that continue.
All right. I want to take this time to thank our guest, Eric Dunn, the American Bar Association's Administrative Law Section, the Administrative Law Review, and Senior Technology Editor Stephen Valentino for all of the help and support to make this podcast a continued presence and contributor to the larger discussions in the world of administrative law. Thank you all for listening. We will see you on the next episode of A Hard Look.